On the show today, President Joe Biden continues to push for aid to Ukraine.
We're going to continue to certainly have those conversations with our partners and allies. But look, and I said this earlier, it does not help. It does not help what we see House Republicans doing.
Plus, the UN approves a multinational force to go to Haiti.
That many of our officers don't even know French or Creole in terms of even communicating with the Haitians, it will be a problem.
And later, more than 100,000 people have fled Nagorno-Karabakh. VOA is there. And things just got wild in the U.S. House of Representatives. Today is Tuesday, October 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. Kenya is ready to send security officers to Haiti as the UN approves a multinational force. We'll have that story in a moment. We begin today, though, with Ukraine. The White House is determined to continue supporting Kyiv, despite what appears to be cracks in Congress and the NATO alliance. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
Cracks are appearing in the wall of Western support for Ukraine as President Joe Biden beseeches congressional Republicans to grant the $24 billion he seeks to fortify Ukraine against Russia's invasion. Congress over the weekend passed a stopgap spending bill that keeps the U.S. government open for another 6 weeks. But that package did not include the Ukraine aid, leading Biden to appeal across the political aisle to legislators who have expressed concerns about accountability and exasperation that the war is still raging after more than 19 months. President Joe Biden.
I hope my friends on the other side keep their word about support for Ukraine. They said they're going to support Ukraine in a separate vote. We cannot, under any circumstance, allow American support for Ukraine to be interrupted. I fully expect the Speaker to keep his commitment to secure the passage and support needed to help Ukraine as they defend themselves against aggression and brutality.
On Monday, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre told VOA that the administration remains determined amid this domestic pressure and concerns from the newly elected leader of NATO member Slovakia, who campaigned that he would not send a single bullet to Ukraine from the state stocks. Jean-Pierre.
NATO alliance, it's the strongest that it's ever been because of what this president's leadership has been. We're going to continue to certainly have those conversations with our partners and allies. But look, and I said this earlier, it does not help. It does not help what we see House Republicans doing.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, hosting European foreign ministers in Kyiv on Monday, said unity is crucial.
Our victory explicitly depends on our cooperation. The more powerful and principled steps we take together, the sooner this war will end fairly, with the restoration of our territorial integrity and a reliable guarantee of peace for the whole of Europe.
And from Moscow, President Vladimir Putin's spokesman appeared to take a dig at the situation, saying Moscow sees tiredness among Western supporters. To which Jean-Pierre replied,
"And if Putin thinks he can outlast us, he's wrong. He's wrong. And so we will have another package of aid for Ukraine soon to signal our continued support for the brave people of Ukraine. And so that's our message. If he thinks he can outlast us, that is Mr. Putin, we believe he's wrong."
But military experts acknowledge that Zelensky's counteroffensive, which aimed to bite off chunks of Russian-held territory, has been slower than hoped. Mark Kansian is a retired U.S. Marine colonel, now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The results have been disappointing, and a number of people are asking the question, how does this end? What is Ukraine's theory of victory? I think President Zelensky is going to have to articulate that in the next couple of months in order to rally his supporters.
But the Ukrainian people remain determined. Over the weekend, the besieged capital held its first full marathon since the start of the invasion. 5,000 participants, many of them service members, some of them amputees, ran the 42-kilometer course to raise money for the nation's defense, step by painful step. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
And on Monday, in a show of support, some of Europe's top diplomats have gathered in Kyiv in a display of support for Ukraine's fight against Russia's invasion. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has that story.
The foreign ministers from the EU's 27 member countries have converged on the Ukrainian capital for an unannounced informal meeting that officials say would review the bloc's support for Ukraine and discuss President Volodymyr Zelensky's proposed peace formula. The US, the EU and the UK have provided massive support to Ukraine, enabling it to stand up to the Kremlin's attack. But uncertainty has set in over how long Kyiv's allies will keep sending it billions of dollars. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Well, the fighting within the Republican Party cost the Speaker of the House of Representatives his job. That story in a moment. Now, late Monday afternoon in New York, the UN Security Council voted to approve the deployment of a multinational security support mission in Haiti in an effort to bring peace and stability to the country. Meanwhile, the Kenyan government says that it's ready to send 1,000 members of its police force into Haiti to help tamp down gang violence. While some Kenyans say it's a good idea, others are expressing concerns. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief, Miriam Diallo, has the story.
Kenyans are divided on the issue of sending 1,000 members of its police force to help quell gang violence in Haiti.
There are countries much stronger than us who could have intervened first. Those criminal elements in Haiti, first of all, I think they don't need police. They need soldiers.
I think that the Kenyan police force is a force that we have. We have faith in it. And there's no reason why we should doubt their capacity.
The Kenyan government says Haiti's far-off location in the Caribbean isn't a deterrent.
We decided we are going to go and help Haiti.
Cabinet Secretary for Foreign and Diaspora Affairs Alfred Mutua recently announced Kenya is ready to lead the multinational police force.
We've got other African nations that are coming on board. We've got other nations from all the world. They're saying if Kenya is leading it, we think there's going to be success. So they're coming on board.
On a recent visit to Kenya, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin lauded the plan.
And we intend to work with the United States Congress to provide up to $100 million in support. And we urge others in the international community to follow Kenya's great example.
Austin was in Nairobi with his Kenyan counterpart, Aden Dwale.
Kenya has a very long history of global peacekeeping. We were in Kosovo, we were in Namibia, we were everywhere. We are now in Somalia, we're in DRC. We have our officers in the Tigray monitoring and evaluation mechanism.
But others, like former Kenyan Defense Secretary Eugene Wamalwa, disagree.
First of all, what interest would we have to be in Haiti as a third world country that is over 12,000 kilometers away, that many of our officers don't even know French or Creole in terms of even communicating with the Haitians? It would be a problem. And even in terms of training and preparation to engage in such a complex security situation where there's urban warfare with guns.
Vincent Kimosop is a Kenyan economist and policy analyst.
It's unprecedented. We only get to hear about Haiti if it is not natural disasters, the issues of insecurity, political instability. But, you know, the people who are in Haiti have an African descent. And one of the, we have an Ubuntu philosophy in Africa. I am because you are, and because you are, I am. Yeah. So when you remove the political, eventually a decision to go help a neighbor who is struggling will be loaded within a broader conversation in the African context.
Kimosop says he supports the administration's decision, but also believes the government should be more transparent and communicate more with the Kenyan public. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And here are other stories we're following from around the world. Indonesian President Joko Widodo Monday inaugurated a $7.3 billion high-speed railway connecting the country's capital with the city of Bandung to the southeast. The project was backed by China and is part of China's Belt and Road Initiative. Two rights groups, Amnesty International and the Media Institute of Southern Africa, have released reports saying Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has failed to break with the past and isn't keeping his promise to allow freedom of the press and access to information. Zimbabwe's Minister of Information defends the government's actions. And Nigeria's biggest labor federations on Monday have agreed to suspend an indefinite strike that had been set to begin on Tuesday, this after last-minute talks with the government. Monday evening in Washington, Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz took the first step in removing Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, from his position. This is a rarely seen move and has the potential to turn politics as we know it on Capitol Hill on its head. For more on the situation, I'm joined by Catherine Gibson, VOA's congressional correspondent.
So Republican Representative Matt Gaetz just filed a motion to vacate, which is a very rarely used procedural element in the U.S. House of Representatives that basically is like a no confidence vote in the Speaker of the House. Gaetz is basically saying that he wants to remove Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy from his leadership position. Of course, if he gets enough votes to make that move, but he has started the process this evening, Monday evening in D.C.
So this isn't actually a vote on McCarthy's job yet. This is a vote to have the vote for McCarthy's job.
That's a great way of putting it. That is how we do it in the U.S. Congress. We kind of, lawmakers state their intention to do something. They file a motion, they file legislation, and then there's a time of consideration. So in this instance, they get about 2 days until they have to make the final vote on the motion to vacate the speakership. And believe me, that is going to be a very busy 2 days up on Capitol Hill when Gaetz will be rallying Republicans and trying to get some Democratic votes. Because as we saw, the Republican Party up on Capitol Hill is so divided right now that really he probably could use the help of Democrats.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. What's the Democrats' role in all this? This is what we're seeing is the Republicans fighting with each other, and the Democrats really don't have a dog in the fight, so to speak. So what do they do?
That's right. That's the most fascinating part of this whole thing as it develops. As you said, the Republican Party is at war with itself. That's why they needed Democrats to pass the continuing resolution last weekend to keep the government open and funded. And so now they're looking to get Democratic votes, and there's a lot of different trains of thought about what the Democrats should do. Some of them don't trust Speaker McCarthy, and they think that they should just step back and let Republicans fight it out, make it a bad look for the Republican Party in front of the American people. They think that only helps their cause. Others are making the argument that they can use this as a negotiating position to extract more concessions from the Republicans.
So if the Democrats vote to keep McCarthy in place, they might be able to get concessions from him. However, if the Democrats vote to let the Republicans oust McCarthy, we might see Congress come to even more of a dysfunctional standstill.
That's absolutely right. You know, you could have Democrats helping pick a new Republican speaker. They could put forward their own nominee if they won't have the votes to get their own Democratic nominee in the speakership chair, but they could do that as well. So a lot of different avenues open to them right now.
Catherine, you've been following The Hill for a long time. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
No, I have not. And from what I understood, the last time this happened was in 1910. So a really pretty unusual occurrence of 110-something years since something like this has happened. So it was really hard to predict what is going to be happening next.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Catherine, thanks so much for your time this evening, and thanks for your reporting.
You're so welcome.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. We'll find out about the Nobel Prize for Medicine in a moment. Up first, Nearly the entire population of ethnic Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh have fled to Armenia, and the one-time residents of the self-declared Republic of Artsakh are scattered. But as VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from near the Armenian border with Azerbaijan, many fear the war that drove them out is not over.
This is Stepanakert in 2020, the city that was the de facto capital of what, until last week, was the self-declared Republic of Artsakh, a majority ethnic Armenian nation within the internationally recognized borders of Azerbaijan. For decades, Armenia and Azerbaijan have fought bitterly over the enclave, best known as Nagorno-Karabakh, or the Karabakh region. And last week, after a fierce assault in mid-September, Azerbaijan won. More than 100,000 residents, almost the entire ethnic Armenian population, fled to Armenia. Ashat Arushanyan, a 45-year-old refugee, stops on the side of the road to fix the truck he borrowed to flee Nagorno-Karabakh. He says he left without clothes and valuables and left his car behind because he had no fuel. People abandoning Nagorno-Karabakh stopped in border towns in Armenia before scattering across the country, with many moving to scantily populated border villages. Others refused offers for free border village homes for fear the Azerbaijan-Armenia dispute would once again cross into Armenia proper as it did in 2020. Ani Aloyan, a resident of the Armenian border village Ishkhan Asar, says bombs crashed into town that year, burning fields and causing terrifying explosions. Azerbaijani officials sometimes call this part of Armenia part of the historical lands of Azerbaijan, provoking ire from Armenian officials. And even teenagers train in military tactics in this region, preparing for possible battles they believe could come to their towns and villages. But families who recently fled their homes also blame the governments of Artsakh and Armenia and Russian peacekeepers for failing to protect them and their land. This is Nayla Grigorian, a 56-year-old refugee who settled in a border village a few days ago. She says the men in her family fought for Artsakh before officials gave the land away without a fight. Left behind on the land, former residents say, is far more than property. They left behind their cultural heritage, the graves of their parents, and the dream of having their own country, one that never quite came true. Arabic Sarjsian, 21, is Nayla Grigorian's daughter. She says she fled the place of her childhood, her bloodline, and the water of her homeland. Like other Armenian refugees we meet, she says she has no hope of returning to Nagorno-Karabakh. But she says she does hope future generations learn the brief history of Artsakh, a place, she adds, that will always call her back. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Ishkhan Asar and Kornitzor, Armenia.
An American and a Hungarian scientist who jointly worked on the groundbreaking technology behind some of the most effective COVID vaccines have been awarded the 2023 Nobel Prize for Medicine. Henry Ridgewell reports.
mRNA technology was crucial in developing the Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccines. Hungarian-American scientist Katalin Karikó and her American colleague Drew Weissman began working on mRNA technology in the early 1990s at the University of Pennsylvania. The Nobel Prize Committee in Sweden said the discovery had helped defeat one of the greatest threats to human health in modern times. Rikard Sandberg is a member of the Nobel Prize in Medicine Committee.
mRNA vaccines, together with other COVID-19 vaccines, have been administered over 13 billion times. Together, they have saved millions of lives, prevented severe COVID-19, reduced the overall disease burden, and enabled societies to open up again.
mRNA, or messenger RNA, instructs cells to make proteins that match those found on the surface of pathogens like the coronavirus. The body sees these as invaders and makes antibodies and T cells to attack them, thus training it to deal with a real virus in the future. In 2005, Carrico and Weissman worked out a way to stop the immune system from attacking RNA made in the laboratory, previously seen as a major hurdle against its use. Carrico said Monday they made a good team.
I was the RNA person and Drew was an immunologist, and we educated each other. And together, you know, we learned each other and developed mRNA.
Weissman said the future potential for mRNA was incredible.
We've been thinking for years about everything that we could do with RNA, and now it's here.
The coronavirus pandemic accelerated the development of mRNA technology, says scientist Paul Hunter.
Now that it's been shown to work probably better than many, if not most, other vaccine types, I think is a big boost to it. And it's, there are a substantial number of potential uses of this technology.
It's hoped mRNA technology could one day be used to fight cancer. Gunilla Carlsson-Hedestam is chair of the Nobel Committee for Medicine.
Vaccines that are targeted towards specific kinds of tumours, maybe even to specific individuals or personalised cancers.
Carrico and Weissman share the prize of $1 million and will receive their medals at a ceremony in Stockholm later this year. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It did not take long for a court in Ho Chi Minh City to sentence prominent Vietnamese environmental activist Hang Thi Minh Hong to 3 years in prison. After a brief one-day trial, the founder of the now-shuttered NGO Change VN, which focused on the dangers of pollution, wildlife trafficking, and climate change, is the fifth environmental campaigner to be sentenced to prison in Vietnam in the last 2 years. Hong was charged with tax evasion. She had closed Change VN in October of 2022, after the government of Vietnam arrested other environmental activists and charged them with the same crime. When Hong was arrested in May, the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights said the chilling effect of such cases brought under tax laws is palpable among civil society in Vietnam and risks stifling debate on issues of importance to society as a whole. The United States is deeply concerned by the conviction and sentencing of prominent environmental activist and NGO leader Hang Thi Minh Hong to 3 years imprisonment, said State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller in a statement. We call on the Vietnamese government to ensure its tax law is enforced in a transparent, impartial manner that ensures non-governmental organizations can operate without fear of undue targeting or prosecution. Environmentalists are not the only members of Vietnam's civil society being targeted by the government. The State Department's most recent human rights report on Vietnam estimates that there are over 170 imprisoned political prisoners and activists in Vietnam, including journalists, academics, members of religious communities, as well as individual citizens exercising internationally recognized human rights, such as the freedoms of expression, peaceful assembly, and association. State Department spokesperson Miller said, "We reiterate our call on Vietnam to release all those unjustly detained and to respect the right of freedoms of expression and association for all persons in Vietnam. We further urge Vietnam to ensure its actions are consistent with the human rights provisions of Vietnam's constitution and its international commitments, including to consult with non-government stakeholders as part of the Just Energy Transition Partnership." NGO leaders like Hang Thi Minh Hong, said spokesperson Miller, play a vital role in tackling global challenges, proposing sustainable solutions in the global fight against the climate crisis and combating wildlife and timber trafficking.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.